Views expressed are not endorsed by the United States Department of Defense or its components. Welcome back to the Flyover Podcast as part of USAFA Aviation. Today is episode 20, and we are privileged to have Colonel Joshua Hustler Egan with us today. Colonel Egan is the head of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. In addition to his teaching duties, Colonel Egan leads 23 faculty, staff, and researchers in the instruction of over 1,250 cadets per year. The department also uses its state-of-the-art laboratories to aid in research efforts supporting a variety of industry and DoD partners.
Colonel Egan earned his commission in 2000 from the Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps at Brigham Young University, where he majored in electrical engineering. He has been a combat-qualified pilot in the mighty F-15E, and while serving as an exchange pilot in the German PA-200 Tornado. Additionally, he was qualified as an instructor pilot in the F-15C, D, E, F-16, and T-38. Following his exchange assignment, he served 1 year in South Korea as a chief of air defense plans, where he was responsible for the plan to intercept and destroy North Korean ballistic missiles and aircraft. Deeply immersed in flight tests since his graduation from the United States Air Force Test Pilot School in 2011, he has conducted test flights into T-38, F-16, C-12, and the F-15 C, D, and E. As a permanent party faculty member at Test Pilot School for 5 years, he spent 1 year directing the school's education and 2 years directing the operational flying division. Colonel Egan is a command pilot with over 2,300 military flight hours in more than 40 aircraft types. He has 250 plus combat hours flying in Operation Iraqi Freedom. His personal interests include hiking and backpacking with his wife and 5 daughters. His military interests include victory.
That last part's
important. Very important. Well, yeah. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I think what we would like to know is all the aircraft you've flown. So I know you have a sheet there.
I do.
With every aircraft. So go for it.
Maybe I should start by saying, A, it's good to be here. B, I'm a little offended. So you guys are in my electrical engineering class last semester, right? The whole semester, I'm telling you stories. Every War Story Friday, cool stuff, flight test, combat stories, what have you. You never told me you were the podcast hosts until my brother sent me a clip on YouTube of, I think it was Major Harp, his F-35, VF-16 kind of conversation. I didn't know the Flyover Podcast was a thing. And I was like, well, I know that guy. And I know the hosts. And they never told me. They haven't invited me either. So I was pretty offended that... You didn't ask me until late.
To be fair, okay. Right? First guest was an F-15 guy.
That's true. And
so we didn't want to double up too soon. And fair. We knew the first guest, Colonel Dietz. I had him in class last fall of freshman year. So
true.
So I guess we knew him before you.
And we are in the history department.
So it would make sense that he...
I'm not complaining that I wasn't the first guest, just that it took me till number 20 to get here. So
we are really happy to have you on, though.
It's going
to
be a good episode.
This will be really fun.
All right, so aircraft that I've flown. So I'm going to go from most number of hours to least number of hours. And maybe a thought or a sentence or two as we go on each one. We'll see. So F-15E, T-38C, most of that was at test pilot school as an instructor. And then PA-200, the Tornado with the Germans. F-16D, the HU-16 Albatross. You guys know what the HU-16 Albatross is?
No idea.
No idea. So Korean War era, a Navy plane, like a seaplane. And we used it at test pilot school as the first check ride for the students. So at the end of the performance phase, so when we stress at the beginning about, how to do like climbs and descents very precisely, cruise points, fuel flow calculations, that kind of stuff. Their very first check ride was in an airplane they'd never flown before, probably even seen before, was the HU-16. So I've got 53.4 hours in the HU-16 when I was A, a student flying it, and then B, later as an instructor. When I was the evaluator on a number of those kind of check rides. So kind of a cool little airplane, really unique to get to fly. And that was my, like, you're in test pilot school moment as a student was, you're getting a check ride in an aircraft you've never flown before. So kind of cool. F-15C is next, C/D, T-38A, the C-12C, AT-38B, the C-12J, which is basically a longer version of the C-12, F-16C. So now we're down below like 10 hours in these aircraft. The KC-135, the AN-2 Colt. Do you guys know what an AN-2 Colt is? No idea?
Cannot tell you.
So I failed you last semester as your instructor. You don't know what all these aircraft are. So AN2 Colt is like an old school biplane, like fabric wings. I think it's wooden construction. And it was actually, I'm not sure if it still is, but for a long time was flown by the North Koreans. And so when I was in Korea, responsible for the defense of South Korea from the North Korean ballistic missiles and aircraft, one of the things we were concerned about was AN2 Colts and how to stop them. And so I left Korea to go to TPS for a week for tryouts. We can talk maybe later about how the TPS tryout process works. And I, Edwards Air Force Base, I'm at my hotel on base. I'm like, I should just check out the drive to TPS, see how long it takes, that kind of thing. So I drive up to TPS the day before the tryouts start. It's a Sunday afternoon, and on the ramp right outside Test Pilot School is an AN2 Colt, and I about fell over because I'd spent the last several months trying to figure out how to shoot these things down and make sure our plan was comprehensive in that respect, and there's one sitting on the ramp. So I got to fly one later. The cool thing about the AN2, their instrument recovery. So if you take it into the weather, which you're not supposed to do, basically the recovery was you go idle. You go full laugh stick, nice and slow, kind of till you get into basically the stall. You go full flaps, and you basically just float down to the ground, and you touch down. When we landed from that sortie, we landed across the runway and taxied clear at the taxiway at the very end of the runway. So that thing, from a like soft standpoint, from a detection standpoint, from a needs very little runway to take off and land. It's kind of a cool, like challenging airplane to worry about. So AN2 Colt, 4.4 hours in that. AC-130H, thus the shell. I've got 3 hours in that. The UH-72 Lakota, so helicopter. Learjet 24, the X-62 Vista, which previously was known as an NF-16D. It's a test pilot school aircraft. Really cool. We can talk maybe more about that if you want, but essentially you can change how it flies on the go. If you want to fly the space shuttle, then you're in that airplane and they type in the right values and you're flying the space shuttle. You want to fly a Spitfire, then you're flying a Spitfire. And so you can change how that airplane flies real time, and it's really pretty awesome. The DC-3, L-29, the Delphine, which was like a Russian two-seat trainer. The Learjet 25, another Learjet version. CH-146, the Griffin, which is a Canadian helicopter. CT-114 Tudor. Think of that as like it's a Canadian jet trainer. If you're familiar with the T-37, so like side-by-side kind of seating jet trainer there. And I think that's what they use for their Canadian, I forget the name of their aerial demonstration team, but that's what they use for that. So CT-114. The T-6 Texan II, so the new T-6. UH-1 Huey, the Goodyear blimp, twice. That was pretty cool. T-1, the UH-60, another helicopter. The A-10C, that was really cool. So I got to fly it, shoot the gun, drop some bombs. That was really awesome. Every bit as glorious as what you think it would be to shoot the gun. So I'd shoot the gun and I'd recover, get back set up for the next traffic pattern or the next pattern, and you just drop your mask and you just like breathe and descent. And it was glorious. The U-6, the Beaver, the CF-188, which is the Canadian Hornet. Think of it as like our old school Navy Hornet, the F-18A. The TG-9 glider, F-18F, the Super Hornet. MQ-9, so a little bit UAVs in there. The T-6A, so the old school Texan back like World War II and later trainer. The JAS-39, which is a Gripen, got to fly that in Sweden, which is pretty cool. M346, which is an Italian jet trainer. You guys still awake?
This is good.
So I got to fly the M346 with a TPS classmate of mine, Marco Mangini, who obviously Italian, and took some TPS students to Rome. I got to fly the M346 up and down the Amalfi Coast, which was pretty awesome. The T-50 Golden Eagle. Any idea what the T-50 is?
A trainer aircraft.
It's a trainer aircraft. That's true. Good job. For what nation?
Italy.
No.
Got a lot Russians. Of Italian planes
Russians.
Here.
Nope. South Korean. So in some way, the easy way to think of it is probably is like 80% the size of an F-16, very similar looking aircraft. So I took some TPS students to South Korea, to Busan, down south, and got to fly the T-50. Some of the first Americans to get to fly it, which was pretty cool. T-33, old school trainer, the MiG-15, which was a lot of fun. And we can talk stories later, but I got to do... I met up with a TPS classmate of mine was in the F-16 in the airspace, and we may have done a little MiG-15 VF-16 dogfighting. So, but you don't want to hear about that right now. You want to know that I also flew the TG-4 glider, the CM-170, the Fuga Magister, French airplane, the Extra 300. You guys know what the Extra 300 is?
No idea.
No idea?
Never heard of that.
Never heard of that one. So it's a world-class aerobatics airplane. So a lot of the aerobatic competitions are flown in the Extra 300. It is rated to plus or minus 10 G, plus or Whoa. Minus 10 G.
So did you test that?
I did a, my plan was to do a half loop, or sorry, a full loop, and then I did half of one. So I ended up doing an Immelmann, and it was like outside loop, I should say. So doing an outside Immelmann, negative 4.5 G, got to the top of the loop and decided I was good. So knocked it off and left it in Immelmann. It felt like it took 3 days for my eyeballs to be like fully seated back in my nugget again, because negative 4.5 is pretty crazy. We also did a maneuver called the Lomčevák, which is a Czechoslovakian word for headache. And basically the airplane tumbles in all three axes, just through the sky, just end over end, rotating side to side. It was pretty cool. Almost done. P-51, which was really fun. The C-17, and then last but not least, a Grob 103, a glider. So 45 aircraft in total. At TPS, I had a stretch where, TPS Test Pilot School, I had a stretch where in 22 consecutive sorties, I flew 21 different airplanes. I had two T-38 sorties. Otherwise, every other airplane was different for 22 straight sorties, which is pretty cool.
That's wild. Well, I guess establishes the credibility for what we're going to go and talk about. So obviously, background electrical engineering, mm-hmm. test pilot, currently the head of the ECU department here at the Academy of Electrical and Computer Engineering. So radar, EW stealth. So
yeah.
Basically, just to like kind of hop right into it, like what are the different realms of stealth technology when it's being applied to the Air Force?
So when you guys think of stealth, what do you think of?
Radar.
Try not to see it.
Try not to see it, right? So story, back when I was like six, so like first grade, Star Trek was a thing. It was kind of a big deal. And I remember my dad would like to come home and watch Star Trek, right? So, and I'd like to hang out with my dad, so I would watch Star Trek with him. You know, Captain Kirk, the whole deal. And the problem was always those Klingons, the bad guys, right? You may not have ever watched Star Wars or Star Trek, I mean, which is cool. But suffice it to say, like, everything would be good, and then suddenly out of cloak would appear this Klingon, like, starship warbird thing that would, like, start shooting at the Enterprise, right? Bad. But the sensors were clear, the scopes were clear, everything was clear, and then suddenly there's this massive warbird, and you're like, well, where does that thing come from? Well, it was cloaking. And so you couldn't find it with your sensors, you couldn't see, you couldn't detect it. So when we talk stealth, as you guys said, what most people think of is just radar, right? I've got an F-22 or a B-2 or presumably a brand new B-21, stealthy as well, that radar can't see it, or it's very difficult to see on radar. But I was talking to some kid that's actually just yesterday who'd been out at Edwards over spring break, and they saw the B-21 flying around. So is the B-21 stealthy if they got to see it? So
not visually.
Not visually, right. So stealth is more than just radar, right? So there's radar, certainly. There's visual, like so cloaking. The Klingon warship was like disappeared, couldn't see it, right? So there's that. There's audio. Can I hear it, right? So can I hear the jet engines as it flies by, whether that's really low altitude or high altitude? So that's another version of stealth that you have to think about too. There's also like infrared. So there's heat from the engines, right? We've got infrared sensors, infrared search and track. There's heat-seeking missiles, right? So there are things out there that can look for heat signatures. So that's another part of it. And then another one still is like electromagnetic radiation, right? So my transmissions, my radio transmissions, for example, my radar transmissions. So those all things can be seen. So when we talk stealth, really you've got to think about more than just radar. It's kind of those five things. So it's radar, it's audio, it's visual, it's IR, and it's also electromagnetic. So it's more than just radar. So in general, though, when we think of stealth, we're thinking just radar, but it's more to it than that. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. That establishes the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you were talking about that electromagnetic stuff, and that's usually how we do like offensive or defensive. And so fundamentally, just for context, what is electronic warfare and what are the different types?
Yeah, so in general, I want to be able to use all my toys, right? I want to use my radar. I want to be able to communicate, want to be able to talk on the radio, use data link, all the things that that we have on our aircraft, I want to be able to use those. Most of those things, those sensors, those capabilities, those toys, do something with the electromagnetic spectrum. So am I able to use them? So when you talk EW, one aspect of it is electronic protection. So am I able to still use all of my toys? Regardless of what you're doing to me, can I use my toys? Electronic protection. Another one is electronic attack. Well, John, you've got things that you want to use, right, from your aircraft, your toys, right, your communication, your radars, what have you. Well, guess what I don't want? I don't want you to use those things, right? I don't want you to see me with your radar. I don't want you to be able to talk. All these things that I want to interfere with, so I've got electronic attack where I can then do things to make it so that it's more difficult for you to be able to talk or to see me with your radar or what have you. And then the third option of that is electromagnetic support. And so that's like, can I see that there's maybe a SAM site out there that's radiating? I can see the radar. I can see that it's looking for me or looking for aircraft. And maybe with various assets, I can locate where it's at. So electronic support is the other part of electromagnetic or electronic warfare.
And so just to touch on GPS, and I know we've talked about GPS before. So how does GPS work? And when we talk about the noise floor and the signal being below the noise floor, can you just walk us through that?
Yeah, so if we go back to the types of stealth, so we talked radar. So there's, you know, F-22, F-35, right, that has things about it that make it stealthy. And I'm happy to go into like the history of how we get into that, the F-117, why it looks the way that it does, all that kind of stuff goes into radar stealth and how we first kind of got into that domain, if you will, for, you know, seeing, so visual, auditory, those are pretty obvious, right? IR, but that other one is that kind of electronic emissions. So it'd be really nice if I could, say, have a radio conversation with my wingman, and you as the bad guy, John, couldn't detect that I'm having that conversation, right? Couldn't intercept it, couldn't interfere with it. And there's a signal where, I guess for you to be able to detect that I'm doing it, if you are tuned to the frequency on which I'm transmitting, you could go, oh, there's something there. It's like if you tune to a radio station, if I had a spectrum analyzer that showed me visually what was going on in the spectrum, I could see that at 97.7, the Air Force Academy's radio station, I can see that there's a big energy spike. It's actually really small because they don't broadcast at high power, but you get the idea, right? I can see that there's a radio station there. Ideally, I could have a conversation with another aircraft and you wouldn't see that there's anything there. So if you tune your spectrum analyzer to 1.57542 gigahertz, which is the frequency for GPS, you don't see anything. So there's just this, you see the universal like background noise. So, you know, if you turn your radio station to a frequency where there's not a radio station, you just get a lot of static, right? So the universe is like, there's just this background noise that is always there. If you think the universe is talking to you, it's not. But there's a universal static that's always there, right? So, and what you see when you tune to GPS frequency is that universal background noise and nothing else. You don't see the big spike that you would see at like a radio station kind of thing. And the reason that's the case is because of the way GPS's signal is set up. It's called spread spectrum. And so it takes the energy. Obviously, GPS is there, right? We can see it. It's on our phones. It's on our navigation and what have you. We're able to use it for navigation and timing and all kinds of stuff. So GPS clearly is a thing, yet when I tune to the frequency, it's not there. And why is that? It's because it's spread out the energy of the signal across a wider spectrum. And so unless you happen to literally have the secret decoder ring, not that they're super secret, but unless you know what to look for, then you can't find the GPS satellites. And there's, I think, 36 satellites in the constellation. And every satellite has a different code they use to spread their signal out. So if I want to find signal 12, or is the satellite of signal 12, I'm going to dial up the code for, it's called a gold code for GPS. And if I've got everything right in sequence, in phase, then out of nothing, out of universal background noise, boom, up pops the signal for satellite 12. And I can use then that to help figure out timing and navigation, all that kind of stuff. So from a communication standpoint, using something like spread spectrum to communicate would be awesome because it hides below the noise floor, and unless you know it's there, you can't see it. I kind of liken it to like a Where's Waldo book. Did you guys see Where's Waldo as a kid? Mm-hmm. I know you're a ballroom dancer. You might have been too busy ballroom dancing to have done Where's Waldo. But so it's got like the red and white stripes, right? So it's everywhere on that screen. And you're like, well, where's Waldo inside that page? Well, once you find him and you know what to look for, then he pops up really easily, right? You can see him. It's the same kind of thing with GPS. If you know what to look for, if you have the secret decoder ring, then it just pops up and there you are. So something like that would be helpful from an electromagnetic standpoint of stealth, being able to talk without people knowing that you're there. So GPS has a lot of really cool properties. That's what allows it to be used from, you know, millions of users concurrently worldwide because of the nature of the signal. But I think it's really magical that it's not there, right? You look for it and it's not there unless you know what to look for, and then suddenly it's there.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. And you touched on this at the beginning of explaining about like radar and stuff, about the history of radar.
Yeah.
And I know that you've done some research into that. So how has radar technology changed over history? And then how has stealth technology changed with those advancements in radar?
Yeah. So I'll ask you a question first.
Yeah.
Does eating carrots make your eyesight better? You guys want to be pilots? If you want to have, you know, 2020, 2015, are you eating carrots at the chow hall?
Not often.
Never. I don't think I've ever.
Have you ever heard
a hard carrot at Mitch's?
Okay. Have you ever heard though that eating carrots makes your eyes better?
Oh yeah.
I think I probably have. Yeah.
Is that a true thing?
Probably not.
It's not. So where did it come from?
Myth.
It's a myth from World War II. So radar, when it first was developed, was in essentially World War II, and the Brits used it a lot. Right? Who was attacking the British? The Nazis were. Right? And they were doing a lot of like blitzkrieg, right? It's night raids, night attacks with their fighters and bombers. And so using radar to detect their airplanes was a huge deal. It was also ridiculously secret. We didn't want the Germans, the Brits didn't want the Germans to know that radar was a thing that existed. The Germans, I think, were researching it at the same time, but the British were farther ahead in its development. And so they would use radar to detect the German aircraft were coming over the channel. And they would launch their fighters to intercept the German fighters. Well, you need a plausible cover story, right? Like, how is it that any time the Germans would send a wave of aircraft, they'd be intercepted by the British?
If I was the Nazis, I'd be pretty sussed out.
Yeah, for sure, right? Totally sus, right? And so the British were like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to start this this disinformation campaign, and we're going to say that our pilots eat lots of carrots. And so they have better eyesight, and so they're able to see at night and see the German airplanes and intercept them and shoot them down. So that, no kidding, is where the myth comes from, that eating carrots is good for your eyes. It's not, right? Eat your vegetables. That's what your mom wants. Your weight college, eat your veggies. But it doesn't actually help your eyesight at all. So radar at the time, a big deal, super secret. A lot of radar stuff now, obviously still a big deal, and a lot of it is still super secret. So there's some things we can certainly talk about, but a lot of radar techniques and things to get into, it's kind of this like black art, same with electronic warfare. So we can talk big picture about some stuff, but not a lot of detail. So the thing about radar is that in general, you are broadcasting and receiving at the same antenna, right? And you're transmitting lots of power. But maybe you and your Focke-Wulf 190, John, you're on the other side of the channel, but I can see that you're approaching. But what's going to come back to me as the transmitter is just a very small amount of energy, right? So I'm transmitting, like, think of me like a megaphone loudspeaker, like yelling electromagnetic signals, radar waves towards the coast, right, across the channel. I'm going to get just a little bit of that back. Well, I can't be yelling and listening for the faintest whisper at the same time. And so they developed what's called pulse radar, where I transmit and then I listen, and then I transmit and I listen. And when I'm transmitting, I can't listen, right? Because if I was listening at the same time I'm yelling, I'm going to blow out my eardrums, my radar eardrums, and I'm not going to be able to hear those quiet whispers. And so pulse radar is a really important thing because I'm transmitting and receiving at the same antenna. Radar, for a long time, the developments were, you know, like putting it in aircraft. Right. So the basic idea, the basic concepts from World War II, they're still true and still in effect. But certainly we've improved the process, shrunk the size, if you will, of the radar. So they're able to now carry in fighters and have really for, Vietnam kind of days have had radar in fighter aircraft. And so then it's a matter of like you're improving the techniques, you're improving these like on the edges, you're improving its resistance to jamming, right? So, sorry, just thinking a little bit. So, let's say that you want to jam me. So we're combining now radar and electronic warfare. So you know, John, that my radar broadcasts at a certain frequency. Let's say I'm at, make up a number, I'm at 1 gigahertz, right? So that's the radar or the frequency my radar is broadcasting. And you happen to know that in my aircraft, whatever it is that I'm flying, that I my radar is at 1 gigahertz. And so you now have a jammer where basically the most simple kind of jamming is just noise jamming, where you're just yelling really loud on that frequency. So, you know, think about you are in we're hanging out in a bar or trying to have a conversation. Me and you and Alex, because he's an annoying third wheel, walks up with the megaphone and just starts yelling in my ear. So I can't hear what you're telling me, right? So that's like the most basic form of jamming is just noise jamming. But you know that I'm at the specific frequency. And so you're sending all this energy to me at 1 gigahertz, and you're jamming me, making it hard for me to pick you up out of all the noise, all the megaphone noise that you're blasting at me. Well, I could avoid your noise if I'm not on that frequency. So frequency hopping is a thing. So if I can change the frequency at which I'm at, say I jump across 10 frequencies, you know, at a tenth of a second per frequency, and you're on that same frequency, and now I'm only jammed one tenth of the time. And so I can see around the jamming because I'm only listening to that frequency one tenth of the time. Frequency hopping we use it a lot. It's Bluetooth. So Bluetooth frequency hops. If you ever think about when you go to the gym, when the gym's not very busy, you're able to, your Bluetooth headphones work just fine, right? Your AirPods or whatever work really well. What happens when the gym gets really full of cadets?
Shorts out sometimes.
It doesn't work, right? Because they're frequency hopping. It's overwhelmed because there's still so much jamming. You can jam a frequency hopper, but now, right, instead of just focusing all your energy on one single frequency, you now have to spread that energy across a wider bandwidth, a wider part of the spectrum. And so the jamming then at each frequency is lower, right? If I'm choosing to jam 10 frequencies, well, that means that each one's going to have one tenth of the original power. So you can do it, but now it takes just a lot more power to jam across that frequency. So frequency hopping is a great idea for radio, perhaps for radar as well, just to make it harder to jam. Another thing that I could do is just sweep the frequency. So instead of just transmitting frequency hopping on one single frequency, during my pulse as I'm transmitting, I can change the frequency. I can, you know, move it up, move it down, what have you. And so same kind of thing. Now there's only a small portion of time where I'm at the 1 gigahertz frequency on which you're yelling at me. That's cool. The rest of the time my radar is outside that frequency band, and I'm not affected by your jamming. So those are just a couple simple things that you can do in radar or communication to avoid the effect of a noise jammer. Someone just on the battle space just yelling really loudly on a frequency. Again, you can jam multiple frequencies. You can jam like the whole spectrum if you want, but it takes a ridiculous amount of power to be able to do so effectively. So that's why in general, when you talk jamming, it's on like specific kind of frequencies. So that's a bit of how radar has evolved and some of the techniques that they will use at a basic level to prevent you from attacking me, right? So your electronic attack doesn't affect me. My electronic protection measures are robust and they keep you from interfering with me using my toys. I can still see you. I can still detect you. And most importantly, I can still shoot you and kill you. That's kind of some radar advancements as we go, right? So smaller form fit factor kind of size, I can stick it in an airplane. And then you get into, I guess at first, radars in airplanes were mechanically scanned, right? So you've got your ray dome, your ray dish, that just kind of sweeps back and forth, left to right, right to left, back and forth, and then up and down. So it just, you know, in order for me to see where you are, John, my radar has to be pointed, the dish itself has to be pointed at you physically. So it's a mechanically scanned radar. In the F-15E, it used hydraulic pressure to sweep. So you've got a 3,000 PSI hydraulic pressure sweeping your super sensitive radar, which caused some issues because that's a lot of pressure, right? And so there were some issues there. But you could actually feel it in the jet. You could feel the radar sweeping from side to side. And on the ground especially, you could feel it hitting the stops. Thunk, 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 thunk. Just the radar sweeping. And you could also feel it when you would go like single target track. I see John, I want to lock you. And so now the radar, the dish kind of vibrates really fast side to side, up and down, and I could feel it shaking a little bit that as it's trying to lock you, which was kind of cool. And there's a lot of goodness with the mechanically scanned radar, but one of the downsides is, again, I've got to be pointed at you to actually see you. So one of the big advancements and one of the things I got to work on as a test pilot down at Eglin was testing an ESA radar, which is an electronically scanned array. So now the ray dish or the transmitting antenna itself, it doesn't have to move. It's stationary. And I can bend the beams. So by essentially inducing a phase shift in each of the waves as I transmit them, I can steer them. So now the dish is fixed. It doesn't move. But I can steer the beams and point them where I want. So it's really easy maybe to have to direct a couple of those and transmitters to look at Alex. And at the same time, I can direct a couple transmitters to look at John. And so without having to like physically steer the dish at Alex and then John, Alex and then John, the radar can devote via its processing. It can decide I want to look at Alex for a bit. And at the same time, I want to look at John. And maybe still look at kind of other things too. So a big advancement in radar. And most of the current radars, easy to find online. So 22s, 35s, they use ESA radars. And the ESA radar and the Strike Eagle and the F-15C and then also the EX, it's pretty awesome. So the latest and greatest is that ESA radar, the fixed transmitter, if you will, doesn't have to move at all, but just electronically steers the beams.
Yeah, so then I guess when we talk like, so that's kind of the history of radar. When we talk stealth now and the history of stealth, like you mentioned the one F-117 and how that then kind of formed into the B-2. And now obviously we're coming out with the B-21 and probably extremely classified. But
yeah,
like what has the history of stealth been alongside the development of radar?
Sure. So at first, let me say, and this is going to date me, but I was in my, I think, early teens, I think, when the Air Force said, hey, we've got the F-117. And then literally, you could look it up. It was like, less than a month later, said we got the B-2, and it was incredible because you're like, I've never seen airplanes that look like that before, right? The F-117, obviously with super faceted, just crazy looking airplane, and then the B-2, no vertical tails. It was an incredible time. You're like, well, what's coming next, right? What else does the Air Force have that's super, super cool, maybe super secret? But with the F-117's development, it actually was a Russian that kind of got things going, and he didn't know really what he had done for a long time. So the Russian was named, I'll probably say his name wrong, Peter, I think, Ufemtsev. And he wrote a really technical paper. I actually wrote the title down because it's a long name. It's called The Method of Edge Waves in the Physical Theory of Diffraction. Essentially what the paper did is it described the method and the equations you could use to determine when radar or radio waves hit a surface, where they were going to go. And at the time, this was, I think you wrote it back in the 50s. So I've looked at the paper. I have a PhD in electrical engineering, and it's like super dense. Now, I don't necessarily, as a double E, I don't love EMAG part of double E. There are other areas that I like more. And so it was a hard read to begin with because it's not a subject I super love, but it's also just really, really dense because there's a lot of math in there. So we wrote this paper, again, I think back in the 50s. There was an office at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the time. That would translate foreign technical papers. And the office translated this paper from Russian into English. And at Lockheed Skunk Works, there was an engineer by the name of Dennis Overholzer who loved EMAG way more than me. And he read the whole paper, and it clicked. He's like, oh, I know where radar waves can go when they hit a surface. That's pretty cool. And so he talked to supervisors. The book Skunk Works talks about all this stuff. It's really, really cool. And they decided to take a gamble on building what became the F-117. The reason it's super faceted is because they didn't have the computing power to, and I think to some degree the manufacturing technology to be able to, with this radar absorbent material, manufacture it in such a way that was something other than like really faceted. But the facets on it allowed them to predict that when the radar waves hit the airplane here or there on that side, what have you, that it's going to reflect somewhere else. The key is, since I'm the radar and I'm transmitting and receiving at the same time, and John, you're the F-117, all you have to do is ensure that the radar reflections off of you don't come back to me. And you're invisible from a radar standpoint, right? So if you can calculate and predict that the radar waves are going to go somewhere else, they'll get absorbed or reflected elsewhere, then you become super stealthy. Thus, the faceted nature and look of the F-117. And that they did all the calculations, and that allowed them to predict where the radar waves are going to go, and it wasn't an issue anymore. Now, sometime later, I forget exactly when, the B-2 development came about. I should back up for a second. When they first went to test the F-117, right? So Lockheed Martin took a huge gamble. It may have just been Lockheed at the time. Anyway, they took a big gamble on building this. They didn't have a contract per se, as I recall. So they built a model of it, and they took it to a radar test facility. And they stuck it on the pole, and they turned on the radar, expecting to see, like, nothing because it was stealthy, right? That's what all the calculations said. It was going to be stealthy. So they're at the radar test facility. They turn the radar on, and guess what they see?
Probably something. A lot, something.
They see a lot, right? They get a huge return. They're like, well, that's not stealthy at all. That's a problem. And they realized the problem was the post upon which the airplane was mounted was not stealthy. And they're like, all right, we got to knock this off. And so they stopped their test, and they built, no kidding, a stealthy pole upon which they could mount the F-117. And same kind of idea, right? Faceted, whatever. They install it, they go back, they put the airplane back on this now stealthy post, and they turn on the radar, and guess what they see?
Absolutely nothing.
They see a lot.
Oh, okay.
There's still a big return. And they're like, what the heck, man? We, you know, stealthy post, we've got the stealthy airplane, or is our math wrong? What's wrong? And they looked out the window, and there was a bird on the airplane. And so they went outside, and they shooed the bird away. They turned the radar back on, and guess what they saw?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. It disappeared. Yeah, and all the calculations are correct, and it worked, right? So I love that story that you realize, oh, it's the post that it's sitting on. Oh, it's a bird, right? It's just kind of this cool process they had to go through and then verify that Pyotr Fentsev and all of his calculations and everything were correct. Dennis Overholzer's insight as to how he could apply that to a real airplane. And they built what is now the F-117. So the B-2... things had changed enough. Again, as I said, the Air Force announced them almost back-to-back, a couple weeks apart. The B-2, I'd have to look at the timeline. The development started, I'm sure, at some point after the F-117. Well, by that point, they had better computer processing technology, right? And they were able to do the math for more than just simple facets on the airplane to then predict where the radar waves would go. And that's why they're able to make the B-2 kind of look the way that it does, because they just had better computer processing power. Though they used a lot of the same, I'm sure, math to figure out where the radar waves would go when it hit the B-2. So that's kind of how stealth came about. It's not just a matter of ensuring that the radar waves don't go back to the transmitter, but there are other things you can do as well to absorb the radar waves, make sure they don't reflect back at all. We can talk radar range equation and the things that go into that and what actually determines how much energy gets reflected back to the transmitter. But suffice it to say that a part of that equation is the radar cross-section. And the smaller radar cross-section you have, the better. A B-52 is going to have, I presume, a giant radar cross-section. Whereas you get into, like, you know, B-2, F-22, what have you, they are, I'm sure, a lot smaller than the B-52.
Yeah, so now follow-up question when we talk about the development of stealth. So I was making sure that everything was good. So RQ-170 Sentinel, the drone, from the Air Force website, is a low-observable unmanned aircraft system being developed, tested, and fielded by the Air Force. It will provide reconnaissance and surveillance in support of the Joint Forces Commander. So obviously that's pretty low level, but... how do you believe that was then developed after we say like the 117 and then the B-2?
So I don't know anything about the RQ-170, but suffice it to say those principles of stealth still apply, right? So we understand the math behind knowing where the radar waves are going to bounce off to and then propagate to, right? So I can design it. Radar waves really love like right angles. They really love discontinuities, right? They reflect really well off of those things. So you can look at even my beloved Mighty Strike Eagle. And you go, it's got lots of pylons, it's got lots of racks and things for holding lots of bombs and missiles and fuel tanks and all that. You probably look at that and go, I bet that's not very stealthy because it's got all those right angles and things. And you would not be incorrect. If you just look side by side, an F-15 F-22, you can see differences in how they are built. And you could probably make a guess that the reason things are built the way they are is because you don't want radar waves to reflect back, right? So understanding now just in general how radar waves reflect off of things, you can then design aircraft that would be stealthy. And then you get into the materials and all that kind of stuff that I don't necessarily know a lot about, but that it helps absorb the radar waves too.
Yeah, so really quick before we go like into your test pilot career, just to touch on a quick, you know, stealth and radar is going to be huge going into the future fight. So what do you think every single Air Force pilot needs to know fundamentally about radar and stealth and how it will apply in the future fight?
You're not invisible. The return is there, right? The question is, can you make the return small enough that it's not, that the radar operator or the software itself, right, doesn't realize that it's an actual return. So with radar, when I transmit, let's say I've got an omnidirectional antenna. So when I transmit, it goes all directions at the same time. So in an ideal, perfect isotropic antenna, which they don't exist, but think of it as like an expanding beach ball. So I'm at the very center of the beach ball or the balloon, I transmit, right? I send out my radio signal, my radar signal. As that beach ball expands, obviously the diameter, the radius, it gets bigger, right? Well, I'm only putting out so much power. So if you think about like an area of the beach ball and the surface of the beach ball, think of it as like a square inch, let's say. When the beach ball is really small, the amount of radiated power per square inch is still pretty high. Well, as the beach ball gets really big, that power density is going to decrease, right? Because now the beach ball is bigger. So a square inch of beach ball now, there's like a million square inches of beach ball around which or across which all that energy is distributed, as opposed to really small beach ball, maybe it's only like 10 square inches, right? So that power distribution gets way less. And as you transmit, that's what happens. So as I transmit my radar, looking to you, John, flying your Su-30, J-20, what have you, that radar wave expands like the surface of a beach ball. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which means, conversely, that the radar power density at each square inch of that balloon, of that beach ball, is now smaller. It's going to hit you. Some is going to get you, right? And then it's going to bounce back. How much bounces back is really dependent upon your radar cross-section, right? Do you have a whole bunch of right angles and stuff on your airplane that love to reflect radar waves back to me? So whatever your RCS is, your radar cross-section, you bounce a bunch of that back to me. Well, when you do that, it's effectively like you're transmitting again. And so from you back to me, it expands again like the surface of a beach ball. And so maybe it's still relatively dense power per square inch when it hits you, but now it's got to travel all the way back to me. And as it travels back to me, it's expanding again. And so now that power density per square inch decreases. So when it gets back to me, the question is, do I recognize that little itty bitty tiny amount of power is you and your Su-30 out there? Or do I go, that's just noise? I think people flying fighters understand radar cross-section. I'm confident they do and kind of all that. And I'm confident they also know that they're not invisible to radar, even if they are stealthy. So the question is really, how do you manage that signature? How do you make sure that the enemy doesn't recognize that little itty-bitty, super quiet, tiny blip that comes back is not something that they want to shoot down?
Awesome. Yeah. So kind of moving away from radar, EW, and stealth, moving into like your flying career, mm-hmm. being a test pilot. So fundamentally, why does the Air Force need test pilots, and what impact do test pilots have on the Air Force?
So how many major commands are there in the Air Force?
10.
12?
9?
Somewhere.
Not somewhere. Sure.
One of you said the number.
I think it's 12.
It's 9.
Okay.
Yeah, so there are 9 major commands in the Air Force. Isn't that like something you have to memorize and you're like...
Well, I can tell you
Once upon a time.
I mean, I can tell you that ACC is in what, Langley, Virginia?
Yeah. That's good. So one of the 9 major commands in the Air Force is Air Force Materiel Command, AFMC. What does AFMC do?
Test, build stuff. They basically do research for the Air Force.
Yeah, acquisition, right? Yeah. It's acquisition command, essentially, right? So research is in there too. Essentially, the simple way to think of it is every new thing the Air Force flies, whether it's a piece of software or a weapon or a sensor or an airplane or what have you, needs to be tested, right? You guys are, you want to go to pilot training, right? You want to go fly. Well, at some point, you're going to be like second lieutenant Snuffy, right? Flying your whatever airplane out there. Let's say it's a brand new airplane. You don't want to be the ones. We as an Air Force don't want you to be the ones to figure out that there's a really nasty aircraft response in a particular part of the flight envelope. And you don't want to figure that out either, because that could very well get you killed. So the reason we have test pilots is to ensure that when something gets fielded, that it's safe. That anything that's any nasty characteristics, right? Maybe when a weapon comes off, and there's video of this, dropping a bomb, and instead of the bomb falling, it flies up. And I've seen the video where, in one particular case, where the bomb comes back up, and the bomb goes through the wing of the chase aircraft and like slices the wing off, and you see the chase airplane start doing a bunch of aileron rolls, and they have to eject. Well, that's probably something that would be nice to figure out before we send it to Second Lieutenant Snuffy out in the field, right? So the purpose of test pilots is to ensure that everything that goes to the field is safe. But also, and this gets into like developmental versus operational test, of ensuring that it meets specification, right? So the Air Force goes, we need a new widget, whatever it is. Let's say it's a new weapon, a new fuse. And they go, we need it to be able to do these things. One of the fuses I got to test was the hard target void sensing fuse. It's kind of a mouthful, HTVSF. So what would the HTVSF do? Well, it meant that in my aircraft, I could tell it what floor I want the bomb to explode in. So I drop it through a five-story building and want it to blow up in the third floor, counting in this case from the top down, right? Well, how do I do that? We can talk about how that actually works, maybe here if you want, or another time to be sure. I need to ensure that A, that fuse survives, right? So the initial impact, because it's pretty impressive impact, but also it's going to function like it's supposed to, right? The Air Force says in its requirements, I need the hard target void sensing fuse to be able to detonate in the appropriate floor. It's got to survive the impact. It's got to be able to like actually tell the weapon to go high order and explode. And it's got to also blow up in the decided or the selected floor, right? So our job as test pilots then is to drop the fuse in such a way that they can verify that the fuse survives the impact, that it's going to send the signal to detonate and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of words to say. I need to ensure that what you as Second Lieutenant Snuffy get to fly in the field works, is safe, and it meets this required specification that the Air Force put out there when they said we need this new widget or this new what have you.
And so when you're testing the safety, there's going to be a lot of times that you get a little bit unsafe, especially with the test pilot. And so it comes with a lot of risks. So where have you seen an application of risk management? And has there ever been a point where it's like, whoa, that was scary?
Or perspective, like if a certain mission had to be flown, like taken back, like, okay, do we really have to do this mission?
Yeah, so risk mitigation is all throughout the whole test process. In fact, there's an office at each test base, test wing, that its sole responsibility is test safety. So let's say I want to test this fuse, right? So I have to do a couple things, right? I need to ensure that the test process that I take it through is technically rigorous to the point where I can then at the end of it say, yep, I answered all the questions, this meets all the requirements or it doesn't, and I have verified that it does in a statistically rigorous fashion. It's not just a bunch of like, it flew really good, off you go, right? I can, here's the data, and I can show you that it works like it's supposed to and then meets the requirements. Train of thought for a second. So there's a technical review that goes ahead of time too. So I write this test plan. Here's how I'm going to test the widget. Here's how I will test the fuse. Then there's a technical board that meets and verifies that, yep, your test plan is going to meet all the requirements, or verify that all the requirements have been met. Then it goes through a safety review process where I, as the safety officer on the project, will then bring in outside folks, people who have nothing to do with the test but who have experience in test, right? Test engineers, test pilots, and they will look at the test plan as well. And they'll go, I think this is okay. I think there are issues maybe safety-wise here. And I also will brief that plan to the test safety office. And they will then sign off on it or not. And as they sign off on it, one of the things that happens is they assign it a risk level. And they say, this is a high-risk test. This is a medium-risk test. This is a low-risk test. Thankfully, most of the testing we do is a low-risk test. And we worked to get to that point. But there are some things, first flight of an airplane, guess what? That's probably not a low-risk test, right? When the B-21 flew for the first time a few weeks ago, it's probably not low risk. But at some point, you have to fly it, right? And so it's in that process, you go, what can we do to mitigate the risk? What can we do to ensure that we're doing everything as safely as possible? Because we don't want to damage the fuse or the aircraft or hurt people or hurt things on the ground, right? We want things to come back intact and like they're supposed to, right? The airplane lands at the end like it's supposed to. So the whole part of the test process and the planning that goes into a test is how do we mitigate the risk and ensure that we can safely carry out and operate this, carry out the test and operate the asset.
Yeah, and do you have like any specific examples of a test that you were going to be assigned to do that you originally thought like, wow, do we really have to do this?
Sure. So April 30th, 2002, what were you guys doing?
I wasn't born yet.
I was born in 2004, so yeah, a couple years.
A couple years. So April 30th, 2002, I was at Moody Air Force Base going through introductory fighter fundamentals, introduction to fighter fundamentals training. So like the learning the basics of how to be a fighter pilot, but in T-38s before I went to F-15E training. I bring up that date because on April 30th, 2002, a test pilot by the name of Major James Crush was his call sign, Dursey, did an F-15 or tested an F-15C out over the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of the Florida Panhandle, and his F-15C disintegrated. He was doing a point that was above Mach 2, carrying an AIM-9X heat-seeking missile. One of the vertical tails in his F-15C disintegrated, and losing directional stability at Mach 2 is a bad thing. I could talk at length, quick tangent, about why I dislike Top Gun Maverick so much, and why I think it's a disaster of a movie. And as we're watching it in the theater, I'm laughing and my wife is elbowing me because I thought it was so ridiculous. The thing that made me the most frustrated, though, and don't get me wrong, I had plenty of buddies who liked it. I liked the cinematography, but the thing that got me the most at the very beginning of the movie was Tom Cruise's lack of test discipline. Do you remember he was flying whatever that new aircraft was that he was testing, and he took it like well past the speed limit that they'd imposed upon him. Test pilots don't do that. He was at Mach 10, right, when his airplane, whatever, broke up, and he ejected and he walked into whatever the cafe was, whatever. An easy way to think of Mach, at Mach 1, you're going 10 miles a minute, so a mile every 6 seconds. So think about riding in the car and sticking your hand out the window at freeway speed, 60 miles an hour, right? And you hand up and down, you can feel the air on your hand, and it's pretty significant at 60, 70 miles an hour, right? That's at a mile a minute. Now you're doing 10 miles a minute, and the forces are pretty significant. Mach 2 as well. Mach 10, ridiculous, right? Now you're doing a mile every 0.6 seconds. His lack of test discipline was a huge foul, I thought, and reflected poorly on what we as test pilots actually do. But also, there's no way he would have survived, right? He would have been atomized. And so at Mach 2, when Crush's F-15C fell apart or lost directional stability and turned, I'm sure, the wrong way to the relative wind, it broke up and he was killed. Tragically, right? So it was then, about 10 years later, so 11 years later, almost. So it was probably late 2012, early 2013. And then Major Egan was an F-15 test pilot at the 40th Flight Test Squadron at Eglin Air Force Base, which was the same squadron that Crush flew out of on April 30, 2002. In fact, by the main entrance to the building was a display of Crush's stuff, flight suit, not from that flight, obviously, but just, you know, a memory of Crush. And so late December 2012, January 2013, somewhere around that time frame, my boss came to me and said, "Hey, Hustler, why don't you do this test?" "Okay, yeah, what's the test?" "We want you to fly an AIM-9X on an F-15C and take it out to Mach 2 Plus and make sure things are good." And I'm like,
same test.
That's the exact same test that Crush flew, right? And they said, yep. And that, I was like, well, is that has that been flown since then? And they said, nope. So I was going to be the first one to fly that test point since Crush flew it and disintegrated and was killed. His jet disintegrated and he was killed like 11, 12 years prior. So what would you say if your boss came to you and said that, asked you to do that?
Why?
Why? That's a good place to start. So, and that was kind of the basis of two of my questions. So the first question was, is the test point required, right? Does Air Combat Command, does ACC need to know that you can fly an AIM-9X out to Mach 2, whatever, edge of the envelope for the F-15C and verify that the missile stays intact and isn't damaged? And they said, yes, ACC wants that point. So then what would you say?
What's changed?
Exactly. That was my question. What's different, right? What's different now, January 2013, as opposed to April of 2002? And they said, well, so we've gone through and we've like structurally across the fleet, we've strengthened the F-15Es or F-15C's vertical tails. The engineers have done all the analysis and they're confident now that they won't have the same structural deficiencies that they had before. So then what would you say?
How confident?
It's a great question.
I mean, you're putting a lot of trust in the engineers, which
yeah. I said yes at that point, right? There were no further questions. Yeah, sign me up. So, because I trust the engineers, right? You kind of have to. At some point, you have to go. I trust the people who are behind this process. Also, knowing that at the same time, there's going to be the whole test safety review process. And in that test safety process, you can bet they're going to be structural engineers. And they're going to look in at all of these things, but in way more detail than my, you know, kind of big overview question of what's different. It's like, okay, well, show me what's different. They want to see at a structural level, like what's different, what's changed. And so I said, yep, sign me up. Now, it just so happened that summer of 2013, I moved to Edwards Air Force Base to go teach at test pilot school. And the test slipped enough to where I wasn't the one who flew it. But a buddy of mine, who's now the ops group commander down at Eglin, Colonel Hamilton, he flew the test point, and thankfully everything went great. So that was, I would say, certainly the most jarring test that I was ever asked to do from a, you know, potential, like, I guess, high risk, you know, risk to life kind of thing. In the end, I didn't do it at all, but I'm confident in the process that prepared the way from a safety perspective for that test to execute safely.
Yeah. So when we talk about being a test pilot, right? There's the one side test pilot school, and then there's the other side being an actual operational test pilot. So what does test pilot school do to prepare you to be a test pilot? And fundamentally, what does like the day-to-day look like as a test pilot?
So maybe the best thing test pilot school does is it makes you comfortable being uncomfortable, because you're going to be put in new circumstances and situations, and you got to be okay in those circumstances, and you got to make good decisions as well. One of the difficulties that test pilot school faces is there aren't specific tracks, right? There's not a fighter track, right? I didn't go through fighter test pilot school. I went through test pilot school, and in my class, I had heavy pilots and half the class is engineers. I'd wizzo in my class, shout out to Tux. So wide background of people in the class, right? And there aren't specific tracks. Navy test pilot school will have like certain tracks, a helicopter track and a sensor track. But Air Force test pilot school, everybody goes through the same curriculum, which is good in some ways, but also bad. But I don't know what you're going to do, right? So John, when you finish test pilot school, are you going to be like one of my students and have the first flight of the B-21? I don't know, maybe. Are you going to go be the first one to fly a new sensor? Maybe. Are you going to spend your career doing kind of like me in my test career, where you do legacy tests on fourth gen fighters like 15, 16, where it's software upgrades and new weapons? Maybe. You just don't know. You're going to do a lot of time talking about the flying qualities of an aircraft, like brand new. Another one of my classmates involved in the F-15 SA program. And it was on her to do a lot of the just how does the airplane fly? Well, I don't know what you're going to do, right? And so I need to have a curriculum that covers a broad swath of topics, which is good because it prepares you for a lot of things. But in some ways, too, it can be a little bad, because I haven't specifically prepared you in great detail to maybe do a flying qualities test. So that's one of the difficulties that that we've that test pilot school faces is how do I ensure in the 48 weeks that you have, because you only have 48 weeks, how do I cram in enough of across a variety of topics to make sure that you're ready to test whatever thing that you are called upon to do, whether it's first flight or just to do a standard software regression test and ensure that the fuel low level light still comes on when it reaches the number that you set in the computer. So that's one of the issues with TPS. As far as and I say that having spent more time in test pilot school's building than any other place in my entire life. And I love the place, test pilot school. It means a lot to me. And so I'm not like trying to just dump all over TPS, but that is one of the difficulties that we don't have specific tracks per se. The day-to-day life of a student at TPS, maybe I'll pause for a second. Any follow-up on that part of it before I talk?
I guess a follow-up on, like you said, getting comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So is that like the operational why behind flying so many different aircraft?
Yeah, for sure. So, well, it's part of it. Think about when you first learned to drive, right? Maybe you had like the family station wagon, and let's say it was a Ford, right? So you're sitting in your Ford station wagon, and you got pretty comfortable driving the Ford station wagon. And then maybe you get more proficient at driving and the parents are like, okay, you can now drive the whatever other car. And let's say it's not a Ford, it's a Chevy or a Honda, what have you. Do you remember what it felt like the first time you sat in a car that wasn't the family station wagon?
Yeah.
What was it like?
It was a little weird, but steering wheel's there, gas is there. So there was an adjustment period.
Yeah. You're like, well, where are the headlights? How do I turn on the wipers? What's it like to change radio stations? Right, things are different, but you're right. By and large, the steering wheel's there. There's still a gas pedal, a brake pedal. You guys probably can't drive stick, can you?
No idea.
Yeah, that'll right. Learn. So you don't know. Yeah. So no third pedal for you, right? So, but the basic idea is the same. So in flying lots of different airplanes, it's a similar kind of idea. So you get comfortable. You sit in a new airplane, right? So when I flew the Fuga Magister, right, a French airplane, I'd never flown one of those before. But in that stretch of 22 sorties of 21 different airplanes, by the end of that, I could sit in the airplane and I could just kind of look around the cockpit and just kind of sweep my eyes and go, yeah, okay, landing gear, fuel gauge, altimeter, attitude indicator, you know, stick, throttles. Okay, I think I'm good. It doesn't mean I knew how to start the airplane. It doesn't mean I knew all the limits associated with the airplane, the landing gear and the flaps and what have you. But I was confident that I had the cross-check now to be able to fly it like an airplane. And that I could do a good job of it. So I got comfortable scoping out very quickly what the new airplane was like. Another benefit to flying so many airplanes as a test pilot in general and as a TPS student in particular is, let's say you're involved in the development of a new airplane, right? Like my student who's B-21 first test pilot. When you're designing a new airplane, if all you've done is spent your whole career flying the mighty F-15E Strike Eagle because it's glorious in every way, as much as I love it, it doesn't mean that it does everything the very best, perhaps from a like information display standpoint. But the F-18's got a really cool AS-L display for its radar. And so when it comes time to design a new airplane or a new sensor, I can go, hey, when I flew that airplane X, whatever it was, F-18, what have you, it had this display that was really cool, or it interfaced with me, or I interfaced with the airplane in this way that was really cool. And so I can then give input across a wide variety of experience in different airplanes. Maybe I only have, you know, 1.4 hours in a T-33, but there's something in there that I thought was really cool and then we could bring into a new airplane. And so by having a wider, maybe a mile wide, but only an inch deep, as opposed to I've flown my whole career in an airplane and I'm a mile deep and an inch wide in that airplane, I can give good inputs on what or maybe the best way to do something in a new aircraft. So all that goes into the reasons why we fly so many airplanes. There's other stuff too, like getting to fly the MiG-15 and see Mach Tuck, right? We talk about it from an academic perspective, but let's go out and fly and see what it's like. So as you get close to the Mach, it actually, the elevator doesn't want to respond in a dive, which is not a very comfortable feeling. So, but let's see what that's like. So sometimes it's, I want you to see the sensor. Other times it's, I want you to see this flying quality so that when you get into the actual real test world, quote unquote, you've got more experience and you're able to give good input on what you're seeing and what you're doing.
And another kind of, to go off the original.
Yeah. So like then, right. So we talked about like TPS and, but what like fundamentally day to day as a test pilot, like operationally look like.
So the first couple of weeks are really just kind of initial prep, getting checked out in, sort of checked out in the airplane, but prepared to do it. So the main aircraft in TPS are the F-16, the C-12, and the T-38, and gliders as well. But before you're going to go fly in those airplanes, you need to have like hanging harness done. You need to have egress training done. So there's a bunch of ground training that's got to happen before you can go fly them. And I've got to teach you about those airplanes. So in general, in my initial, for example, F-15E training course, I think it was 6 weeks from when, like, day one of the class till I actually sat in an airplane. And in those 6 weeks, it was a lot of academics. It was a lot of simulators and training. It was sims of varying fidelity, right? Sometimes I started off with, like, cardboard almost mock-ups with switches. And then you progress to the sim that's got, you know, all the viz and all that kind of stuff. And so you're practicing starting procedures and emergency procedures and all that kind of stuff. So it's a long process to get to where you even get your first flight in the airplane. Well, at TPS, at about the three-week mark, now you're going to start flying three different airplanes. And you're going to get T-38 ground school. Like, here's all the systems in the T-38 in, like, a day. Or here's all the systems in an F-16 in, like, a day. And so it just moves really, really fast. And so part of what you learn to do as a test pilot is, what do I really have to know? I've got the Dash 1, the flight manual, right, that is in a fighter jet. It is hundreds of pages long. Right, and it talks about all the systems in great detail and all the emergency procedures. And you're like, well, what do I actually need to know to go fly this thing and do it safely? I probably need to know how to get out of it if something goes wrong. So that's what egress training is for. I probably need to know basic speeds, like, so I don't overspeed the landing gear and G limits, that kind of stuff. So you learn to kind of prioritize, as opposed to learning everything about the airplane before you first get to fly it 6 weeks in. You get like the super condensed version of, this is what I have to know before I go fly that thing. So the first 3 weeks are preparation to go fly, and then you start flying. You get checked out in, everybody gets checked out in the T-38, and then either you'll be in the T-38 group, the F-16 group, or the C-12 group, and that's for that initial performance phase. So you, in my case, I got an F-16 qual, so I got to fly solo without an instructor with a student FD engineer in the back, I should say, in an F-16 after four flights, which is pretty awesome. So you get checked out in your airplane, in your data group, and then you start learning about test techniques. In general, though, aside from that very initial phase of how do I get safely flying an airplane, how do I teach an engineer who potentially has never, ever flown in an Air Force aircraft before how to safely fly in the backseat of an F-16? So there's a process to spin them up and get them ready for that. But in general, what you're doing is you've got academics and flying going on concurrently. So when you're the baby class, so the classes change out every 6 months. So the first 6 months, you're the baby class, and then the second 6 months, you're the senior class. And when you're the baby class, let's say you're flying first go, so you've got the early flights. And then when you're the senior class, you get to sleep in a bit more, right? A little bit maybe, and then you get to fly in the afternoon. So you would spend, maybe go fly, you know, over the course of 5 days, Monday through Friday, you might fly, it depends on the week certainly, but maybe three or four times, maybe five times, and potentially the F-16, the C-12, and the T-38, three different airplanes. And then in the afternoon, you get 3 hours, 4 hours of academics. So maybe we're teaching you radar, where you're going to get Monday through Thursday, 4 3-hour blocks of radar, and then Friday you have a test. And then the next week you get essentially a whole semester of undergraduate aero in 4 days, and then you have a test. And then the next day you get maybe COM or NAV or GPS or what have you. And then not every class is built 4 days and then a test. Some are a little bit shorter. And not every academic thing has a test. But suffice it to say, at the end of it, you get a master's degree, a Master of Science in Flight Test Engineering, because you've spent half your time in academics and taking academic tests, and you can get kicked out academically, much like you can in pilot training. And the other half of the time you spend it flying, lots of different types of airplanes. So you're working basic academics, you're doing homework, you're studying for tests, while at the same time you're prepping for sorties. Every flight is going to be a little bit different. We're teaching you different flight test techniques and how to do different things and how to interact with the control room and with the test engineer. On top of that, too, you've got different projects that you're doing. The big one is like a capstone project where you, over the course of 8 months of your 12 months at TPS, you're building a test program from scratch. So you're going to go test a brand new thing for the very first time that maybe someone from a university or from a company has brought in and want us to test. So you as the students with us as faculty guiding you through it. You write the test plan, you do the technical planning, the technical review, the safety planning, all that kind of stuff. And then you get 2 weeks to execute your test. So you're doing all that in addition to having tests most every week and check rides and various flying events. And so it gets pretty busy. There's a lot going on. There about the last 6 weeks of TPS, I thought it was the busy. At the time, it was the busiest I had ever been, because there's just so much that's due, so many final projects, so many reports to write, and it gets to be a lot. But at the same time, you have a stretch where you fly 21 different airplanes and 22 sorties, and you go to Sweden and you fly the Gripen, and you go down to LA and you fly the Goodyear Blimp, and you're in a MiG-15 and you're doing kind of dogfighting with an F-16. So you're having these experiences that are incredible. But it's a mix of not just flying. There's a lot of academic stuff involved as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool to do.
It's awesome. Cool life. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, and I could tell you lots of stories about shenanigans and about, you know, every airplane on that list. I could tell you, well, in that sortie we did this, or the Blackhawk was awesome because we did that, or in the old school T-6 we got to do something called tactical proficiency, which I'll tell you about another time. And just really, like, a Reno Air Race pilot was my instructor pilot on that sortie, and just really, really cool stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, cool.
And so, quick question. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, but what is Auto GCAS and how did it come to exist?
And especially, like, I think you were, when you were talking about, like, different types of tests, like, you've spent a lot of time in, like, upgrading current aircraft.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, Auto GCAS came to be, and I'll just kind of let you take it from there, but I guess to just kind of preface the question.
So, have you heard of G-lock before? What's G-lock?
Pass out. Yeah. You're pulling G's.
Yeah, gravity-induced loss of consciousness. Yep, so when you pull positive G, so think about from you're sitting down from your nugget to your rear end, we pull positive G, the blood flows from your brain. You ever been on a roller coaster or stood up too fast, even from the couch, and you get, like, sparkles in your eyes? The eyes are the most sensitive organ in the body to lack of blood. And so in the airplane, that can happen too. So if you pull G and you're not straining appropriately, and there's techniques we use, there are G suits we use to help basically squeeze your body and squeeze your muscles to keep the blood in your brain. The eyes are where you notice it first. So you might get a little sparkle, a lot of sparkle. But if you don't get on your G strain appropriately and you pull too many Gs, then there'll be no more blood in your brain, which means that you pass out. Spoiler alert, it's pretty hard to fly an airplane when you're unconscious. And if you are in a flight regime where, and it can take you do what's called the funky chicken as you wake up, because you're, like, shaking all over the place as your body figures out, like, oh, I'm back and connected to my muscles again, everything's good. But it can be 30 seconds or a minute where before you are able to perceive and do anything again, let alone, like, fly an airplane. And so if you G-lock at an inopportune time, let's say you're in 90 degrees of bank because you're doing dogfighting, so you're pulling high G. At 90 degrees of bank, how many G do you have to pull to maintain level flight?
90 degrees bank.
How about at 60 degrees of bank? How many Gs do you have to pull to maintain level flight? Come on, you guys have done steep turns. When you do a 60 degree steep turn, how many G do you have to pull to stay level?
60 degrees steep turn, I mean, it's two.
It's like exactly two, right? Yeah. So the steeper the bank, the more G you have to pull to maintain level flight. And if you do the math, at 90 degrees of bank, you have to pull, like, infinite G to stay level. So if you happen to pass out in dogfighting and BFM, basic fighter maneuvers, as we call it, at 90 degrees of bank, you're going to stop pulling the G. And so what's the nose of the airplane going to do?
Going
to
drop.
It's going to drop, right? It's going to start to point towards the ground. And in dogfighting, you probably have your power setting up high. So if you are at, let's say, mil power or afterburner, you're 90 degrees of bank and the nose starts to go through the horizon down towards the ground, what's going to happen to your airspeed?
Increase
a lot, really fast. And depending on how high you are, you could end up pretty nose low, going really, really fast. And you may very well wake up in time and go, hey, there's a lot of ground there. But you may not have enough time left to do anything about it, and you become a giant smoking hole in the ground. So what Auto GCAS does, Automatic Ground Collision Avoidance System, it prevents you. Well, it doesn't prevent you. You can still G-lock, but what it does is, in the background of the jet, there's a computer that knows or a database in your airplane that knows the elevation of the terrain around you. It's called DTED, Digital Terrain Elevation Data. So the jet knows the DTED and it goes, hey, you're flying over the Academy and the elevation of the Terrazzo is, what's the elevation of the Terrazzo?
7,258 feet above sea level, far above that at West Point or Annapolis.
Okay, very good. So you're 7,258 feet above the Terrazzo, right? And the jet knows that over the TISO, you're 7,258 feet. And it also knows your attitude and your airspeed. And it goes, hey, if you're in a dive, then I need this much altitude to recover from that dive. And so these calculations are always running in the background. And if it's like, hey, man, you're getting really close to where if you don't do something about it, you're gonna be at risk of crashing into the ground, the jet starts to display information to you that you're getting really close to the ground. And in the F-16, at least, it does that by, it's got a pair of chevrons that start on either side of your HUD and they work towards the center of the HUD. It doesn't make any noise. You just see these chevrons in the HUD. And it's the jet telling you, hey, you're getting close to where I'm about to jump in and do something. And then when the chevrons touch, there's a tone, beep, and the airplane rolls itself upright, rolls wings level, and then it pulls. It's got a maximum G's that it pulls. I think it's like 5 or 6. And it pulls you and recovers you away from the ground. And hopefully in the time that it takes for all that to happen, and now you're pointed away from the ground, you wake back up and you can go, oh, hey, I'm not a smoking hole in the ground. That's great. I'm so glad. And then you live to fight another day, and the jet also lives to fight another day too. So AutoGCAS is a computer program that runs in the background that knows your aircraft parameters, knows the elevation change you need or the altitude lost during a dive recovery. And if you get yourself in a dangerous situation, it will recover the jet and keep you from dying. Last I'd heard, in the F-16 alone, it had, I think, 14 saves. So that's 14 people that are alive today because of AutoGCAS. So there's a publicly released YouTube video of an AutoGCAS save. So we can post a link to it on the, episode page or what have you.
Yeah, it'll be down in the description. We'll do our best, or we'll just give you like a title to search on YouTube.
So, and what you see is an F-16 pilot. It's one of his first BFM dogfighting sorties. He's offensive, so he's behind the other airplane. You'll see, maybe be a little frustrated by the fact that there's a bunch of the screen that's blanked out, and it's because it's weapon symbology and you don't get to see all that stuff. So they go into the start of the fight, they call the fights on, go into the break turn, and you can see that he gets up to, I think it's like 8.2 G, and you can hear his breathing and he passes out. And then you'll see the jet, as we were talking, 90 degrees of bank, he's in full afterburner, the nose starts to drop. And he is out cold and after a few seconds. And it's really hard to watch, especially for me, having done those same maneuvers and flight lead wingman, all that kind of stuff. And you hear the flight lead start to yell, and to recover. And you look at it and you go, he's dead, right? The moment he passed out, he's dead. There's no nice way to say it, right? He's a giant smoking hole in the ground. And he gets to like Mach 1.1, 1.2, something like that. It's like 50 something degrees nose low. He's essentially inverted. Again, Mach 1.1, 50 degrees nose low. And then you see in the HUD, these chevrons appear. Just nice and quiet. You see the chevrons and they like work closer and closer and closer. And they touch in the middle of the HUD and you hear this boop and the jet rolls upright and then pulls whatever it is, 4, 5, 6 G. And recovers the jet back above the horizon. At some point in there, he wakes up, and you'll see the G spike as he gets on the stick and yanks on it, so to speak, in order to help recover the airplane. He bottoms out somewhere around 3,000 feet AGL. So if you were to do the math at Mach 1.1 or whatever, and you're 50 degrees nose low, how long would it take you to cover 3,000 feet to the ground? Not very long, right? Certainly, he would not have woken up and recovered by then. So it's a sobering video to watch from the perspective of someone who has done dogfighting lots and lots of times. But from a test pilot perspective, and you go, this is something that we as a community made. I wasn't involved in the testing of it, that has saved a lot of lives, like a direct measurable impact. And it's pretty awesome. We get into some of the test stuff you were asking before, Alex, about safety and potential loss of life and all that. How do you test that? How do you test that the aircraft is going to jump in? And when you're Mach 1.1 and 53 degrees nose low, essentially inverted, that it's going to recover in time to save you. How do you test that?
Unmanned aircraft?
Nope.
you set the computers to think that the ground is a lot higher than it really is.
You nailed it. Yep. So you've got that DTED, digital terrain elevation database, in the airplane, and you just go, I'm just going to add, let's start with 5,000 feet to that. And so you can practice the recoveries and maneuvers and see if the jet responds as it's supposed to keep you from crashing into the quote unquote ground when it thinks that the ground is a lot higher than it is. But at some point you got to go, we need to test against real ground. And so how they did that, there's some really cool SETPs, the Society of Experimental Test Pilots, and there's some really cool SETP presentations about auto GCAS and the testing they did. And then how you, how do you jump in if you're the control room and tell people that something's wrong? How do you tell the pilot that the system's not working? And how do you, what happens if you're on approach to the ground and you hear radio transmission? What do you do? And it's fascinating talking through all the, if the radio clicks at all, we're recovering, because it might be that someone's trying to tell me that the system's turned off and you need to recover. Or maybe it's another transmission that is then blocking the transmission that says the system is broken, you need to recover. So at the high risk, throw yourself at the ground literally and see if it saves you. Any radio transmission, all they would recover. And so fascinating stuff. You can get into the weeds and see kind of how they tested it. But that whole test team deserves huge kudos for installing a system that has saved a lot of lives so far.
Yeah. Okay, so now transitioning a little bit to the future of the Air Force and talking about kind of radar and radar stealth technology and maintaining a competitive edge. How do you believe the Air Force should best maintain our competitive edge, especially in stealth technology, over our adversaries?
That's a good question. It can be a hard one to answer. Really what we need are engineers, right? And Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary Kendall, I think it was his very first interview when he took over as Secretary of the Air Force in 2022, I think, he said, we need more engineers, right? The reason we got the F-117 and a lot of the stealth technology we have now is because an engineer, Dennis Overholser, read something and made some connections and was able to then introduce some new technology. So I don't necessarily, if I knew what we need to do this thing in order to keep us ahead of all of our adversaries, I'm certainly not going to tell you here and now for obvious reasons, right? But what we need are people who have a broad knowledge and experience, right? Who can make connections that haven't been made before. It may be that there's something out there, much like Dennis Overholser read and then put together, that we just need to figure out how to apply it to our current technology to maintain that edge. But whatever it is, I would hope that we're already working on it. And I'd hope that we've got smart people who are helping to advance that. I've been involved with a lot of engineering stuff and seen a lot of behind the scenes stuff and talked to the engineers who have designed certain things or wrote the software code or what have you. And you sit in their briefs and they tell you what they've done. And I literally have wanted to standing ovation, shake their hand and go, that's incredible. I don't know how you figured out that math and how you made that work, but kudos to you for doing that. And so we need people, smart people, who are engineers, yes, like the secretary said, but certainly not just engineers, who can make new connections and figure out new technology so that we can stay ahead of our enemies. But again, assuming that we're doing that now, I hope that we are. But we're not going to hear about that on a podcast.
Of course. Yeah. Accelerate or lose.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I don't know how much you can answer this question, but as China continues to expand its reach, how prepared is the U.S. if it were to have to fight a war in the homeland, specifically relating to radar technology, like we had those Chinese spy balloons come over?
Sure.
Yeah. And to preface it too, right? The U.S., we've been fighting offensive wars
since the 40s.
What? Since the British burned down the White House? I mean, yeah. I think a homeland, continental right. United States. And now, right, now as China roars back to the world stage, what's not to say they're going to bring the fight to us eventually?
Sure. So I've never been assigned to NORAD, NORTHCOM, right? But they're assigned to Homeland Defense. And I'm sure that they know a lot about all that kind of stuff. I don't necessarily. Here's what I can envision or tell you when it comes to radar stuff and homeland stuff. So radars in general, there's a lot of clutter, right? So anytime the radar hits the ground and comes back, your radar is going to receive the ground return. Well, I don't want to see the ground on my radar, right? I'm looking for enemy aircraft. I don't want to see the ground. So I don't want to see birds. There's a lot of stuff I don't want to see. I don't want to see chaff, right? As we talk about electronic warfare, chaff is a form of electronic warfare, right? So I put out some aluminum strips or metal strips behind my airplane that are juicy targets for radar, and hopefully the radar locks onto the chaff and not me. But I don't want to see chaff in my radar. So there are settings in your radar you can dial up to say, I want to see this stuff or I don't want to see the other stuff. Speaking broadly there. And I would assume that when we talk in homeland defense radars, that there's similar kind of things, right? That some clutter stuff you don't want to see and doesn't matter to you. One benefit to ground-based radars, coastal defense, what have you, you're not limited necessarily on the power that you can transmit. So in my F-15E, as we're doing the radar test, one of the big concerns is just heat, right? So you're transmitting a lot of power. Think about a giant light bulb in an enclosed space. It gets kind of hot, right? So and the brighter the light bulb, maybe more old school incandescent bulbs as opposed to current LEDs, but the more wattage, the more power with them, the hotter they got. And so just keeping the radar cool on the F-15E was an issue. Certainly that's the case to some degree on ground-based radars, but I can dial up the power, right? I can turn it up to 11 and I can transmit a whole lot of power. As we talk about radar range equations and when I can detect stuff, one of the big terms in that is power transmitted. So certainly the more power I transmit towards you, John, and your J-20 or what have you, the more power I'm going to get back, right? So just cranking up the power is going to be a good way to detect aircraft earlier. And if you've got ground-based radars, which I assume that we do, well, if I just crank up the power, that's going to help. Other things that help too are like the gain of the antenna. How directional is the antenna? So as you have a giant radar, if I can have a more focused beam, then that's going to help me detect something better at a longer distance, I guess, as well. So I presume that we as a nation in our coastal defense have radars that can broadcast at a pretty high power setting. There's such a thing as over the horizon radar, and that we've got pretty directional antennas that allow us to, again, increase the received power that we get, and we can detect aircraft coming over the horizon earlier. So I guess that's what I would say. Homeland defense, I would hope, presume that should the fight ever come to us, that we're going to fight, you know, every bit as tough as we always do, if not more so, because it's like on home soil now. But I have to think that we've got technologies and radars and stuff to help see those things when they're coming.
Okay. Yeah. So, and talking about like preparing for that future fight, right? You're the head of the EC department here, electrical and computer engineering. We're both ECE majors. And so what do you believe ECE gives to cadets, like their background, to then expose them, and how will it help them in the operational flying environment, and how will it prepare them for the future fight?
So first, let me say that I wholeheartedly agree with Secretary Kendall that the Air Force needs more engineers. I think that the 21st century battle space is the electromagnetic spectrum and the manipulation thereof. Can we as a U.S. Air Force, can we manipulate and utilize and bend the electromagnetic spectrum to our will better than our adversaries? And I think that's what's going to determine a lot of whether or not we win or not. So I think that having an understanding of that spectrum and how we can use it is nothing but advantageous to us as members of the Air Force, whether we're pilots or whatever else. Maybe I should caveat by saying I've flown against and flown with, trained with plenty of pilots who are not STEM majors, electrical engineering majors, and guess what? They can employ the aircraft really, really well, right? This isn't if you want to be a good fighter pilot or a test pilot, you have to be an engineer. However, I think that having an understanding of how the systems work, when we talk radar range equation, you can understand why there's a range to the fourth power in there, and you can understand the math behind it. And I think that understanding the concepts, how time division multiplexing works so that you're able to then have a data link, that you're better able to utilize and put those sensors and those tools and things to work because you understand how they work, I think is only a good thing. So all that said, I don't want to be a lawyer or an accountant. No disrespect. Shout out to the law department, right? So I understand that not everybody wants to be an ECE. It doesn't hurt my feelings. But what we need are people who are looking to challenge themselves and to do a major, pick a career path that will be advantageous to them, certainly, but also the Air Force. And so passionate about finding engineers, finding people to teach and to train. So I think that ECE, especially in our current battle space, and I think the future battle space, it's only going to be more so, best prepares you to know how to leverage that spectrum to the best of our abilities.
And I'll say I had a ton of fun in class with you last semester.
ECE 215 with Colonel Egan.
It was really cool.
War stories every day.
Always wanted war stories. I'm a little bummed. Some of the current class, I'm like, all right, we finished 2 or 3 minutes early. You want a war story? And they just stare at me like, I don't know. I don't have any questions.
They don't got the...
Hurts
got,
my feelings.
They don't realize how many...
John Costello. They don't got... Who else? We got Flynn. We had Jonathan. Yeah. It was a great time in that good. Class. It was a good group of people. Cool.
Yeah.
But you're preparing to retire. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time in the Air Force. And as you prepare to retire from the Air Force, what's one thing, if you could, would you change about your career?
So... From an assignment process or perspective, I guess, there were some assignments I wasn't excited about. I was not interested in going back to TPS to teach. After I graduated from test pilot school, was doing an F-15 test. I mean, living on the beach at Eglin Air Force Base, flying the latest and greatest stuff, was pretty awesome, right? My Wizzo buddy Tux and I, we kayaked to and from work. It was awesome.
It's kind of hard to beat.
Right?
How does that work on a military base? Or were you living on base? Or
nope. Like? Living across the bay. And we just we commuted into work together one day. And then at the end of the day, we went down to Outdoor Rec and we rented kayaks. And we paddled across the bay. I lived, the house that we rented backed up to kind of an open space. And so we paddled the 4.5 miles across the bay. And we got to the open space behind my house. And we picked up our kayaks. We left them in my backyard and... He went back to his house and came back the next morning, and we hopped back in the kayaks and went back to base, and it was awesome.
I think the true question there is, were you in a flight suit or were you in cities?
I was not in a flight suit. Yeah, we left change of clothes in the car on base, and then got cleaned up afterwards. But so living there and doing all that stuff, it's like I did not want to go to test pilot school to teach. They kind of non-volunteered me, sent me to go, and I wasn't happy about that. It worked out great, and I guess... So from an assignment perspective, even some of the things that I thought weren't going to be awesome turned out to be great. I think the things that I would change were more like a couple day-to-day experiences here and there as opposed to the broad overall career path. To step away from the flying for a second, when I was in Korea, the area in which I worked was predominantly male, but there was one, a woman who came into the... our particular area a few months after I'd gotten there. And there was another person who worked with us. And I felt like he said things to her that I thought were inappropriate in a harassing sort of way. And I'm like, I got to do something. I'm not comfortable with what he's saying, right? So I need to do something about that. So what would you do? You're witnessing somebody say what you feel like are harassing things to another person, in this case a woman, what would you do?
I'd probably talk to people around me that aren't either party and see what they think.
Okay. That's a good one. Alex, what would you do?
Maybe try to deflect the conversation. So if you want to interject and say like, hey, how are your flights today? Or get them talking about flying.
But this wasn't just a one-time thing. This was happening like a couple times a day. So I don't think your ideas are wrong necessarily. What I decided to do was I talked to her and I said, hey, I'm not comfortable with what's going on. And you could tell, right, that it affected her, that she wasn't enjoying it either, and asked her if she was okay. She told me that she was. That's not what I would do now, right? I would go to him and I would say, shut up, right? You are way out of line. What you're saying and doing is wrong. You need to stop or I'm going to elevate it beyond just this conversation between me and you. That's a big regret in how I handled that situation. I would do that very differently now as opposed to what I handled it back then. I had a miss in a bomb that I dropped.
We've heard this story before.
I was in a test flight, and I still have regret about that miss. That was the one real miss, significant miss of my whole career. And I have regret about that. And then the other real regret that I have, and you asked for one, but you're getting three. When I was in Korea, another time there in Korea, I got to go out onto the USS George Washington aircraft carrier. And aircraft carriers are a maze, right? Like I don't enjoy spending time necessarily on Navy BOATs. It was a cool experience. But we kind of like, they escorted us into kind of this waiting room as we're waiting to catch our flight back home. And we landed the carrier, went off to an Aegis cruiser, spent a couple nights there, went back to the carrier, and then we're going back to the peninsula. And so we were on the way home at that point. Needed to go to the bathroom and didn't realize the way the Navy handles that. And they have bathrooms that are like different by rank, right? So if you want to use this bathroom, like you have to be an officer. You want to use that bathroom, you have to be at least an E6 or what have you, right? However, they kind of break it down. Well, in our group was, I think it was a staff sergeant. And again, it's a maze. And I walked down the hall and I could see that there's a men's room right there. And so go in the bathroom. And it said it was for officers, whatever. I was a captain, it was all good. So go back to where we're waiting. And the staff sergeant's like, oh, hey, where'd you go to the bathroom? And I told him, well, hey, just down the hall there on the right, there's the restroom. And I almost was like, but it's for officers. But then I thought, I have no idea where I would find another bathroom on this whole aircraft carrier, right? The place is a maze. And so I just told him that's where it was. And when he finished and was walking, he was walking out the door, going to turn, I think, left to head back our way. And I happened to be close enough to the door that I could hear what happened. And I think it was a more senior enlisted member of the Navy saw this, you know, staff sergeant walk out of the officer's bathroom and like lit into him. And I heard the whole thing and I told him he could use that bathroom. I didn't step in and say anything. I didn't jump in and go, hey, chief, or I don't remember the man's rank. We're visitors, right? We didn't know where to go. I said it was cool. I didn't do anything to get him out of a undeserved talking to. That was on me. So the regrets that I have in my career aren't necessarily assignment related. It's a few individual things here and there where I'm like, I handled that wrong. And I wish I handled that differently. And I would do differently now, right? I'm a different person, maybe hopefully a better person than I was when I, you know, joined up 24 years ago. But those are the things that I regret.
Yeah. And so talking about like reflecting back and now looking forward, right? So you're going to retire, I think, this coming fall or?
Yeah.
And so sometime in the future. And, right. And so what does the future hold? What's your plan post-military?
The short answer is I'm not sure. So I've applied for retirement from the Air Force to be effective 1 Feb 2025. That was 2.5 weeks ago, and it takes them a few weeks to get back to you with an approved retirement date. So I don't have any reason to suspect that they would not let me go. So I'm operating off the assumption that 1 Feb 2025 will be it for me, and that'll be 24 years and 9 months essentially from when I commissioned. And I'm not like cynical or bitter. Like I've had a really, really awesome career. I've got 5 college degrees and the Air Force paid for 4.5 of them. So, awesome experiences, incredible people. But as far as what's next, I'm not sure. I don't want to bore you with all the different things that I talk about with my wife and, you know, we could do this or could do that or whatever. Suffice it to say, I'd like to think that, between all my experiences, flying, test pilot, PhD in EE, that there'll be opportunities out there. I don't know if it'll be inside or outside the defense industrial complex, but... I will miss the interacting with cadets, though. It's been, we used to hate on the academy at BYU. Back in the day, we were in the same athletic conference. We'd make fun of all the cadets. And, and on active duty, I'd have bets with my squadron mates who were from USAFA anytime BYU and USAFA played football or basketball and just friendly wagers. And so I never thought I'd come here. I flew over it once in a Strike Eagle. But it's been awesome to be here and to, you know, tell stories to cadets of not just cool flying stories, but like the stories about that, you know, the sexual harassment stuff that I did wrong. And that hopefully I can pass along some knowledge to you guys. So it's been great. Whatever the future holds, I'm confident it'll be good. And
We are going to miss you.
And for sure. Yeah.
You got one more?
Of course, we got one more question. Yeah. I mean, as is tradition here on the Flyover Podcast, right? And I want a single aircraft, right? We've had previous guests who kind of try to give us a little bit of a broad answer, but what is the best aircraft in the Air Force's inventory and why? You've flown 41 aircraft.
45.
Yeah. You got a list of them. And there's, I don't think the F-22's on there.
So I've done F-22 SIM, F-35 SIM, B-2 SIM, C-5 SIM, but not actually flown them. The only single seat I've flown, other than the 15C and the 16C, was the A-10. Maybe as I like think through it, I'll tell you a story or two about some other ones. The Blackhawk was super cool to fly. Flew it out of Navy test pilot school. We essentially, it was an empty airplane, empty helicopter, right? So unloaded. So it weighed like 12,000 pounds. Max gross is like 21,000 pounds. So we had power for days. So we were able to we did terrain following. So you're flying met nap of the earth, below the tree line kind of stuff, out over the golf course, and there's water and there's, golfers, and you're just joyriding in this Blackhawk. And it was awesome. That was really fun. F-16 story. So I mentioned that I was in the F-16 group at test pilot school as a student. One day they threw me the keys to the F-16, and I had a student engineer in the back seat. It was a clean F-16. There wasn't anything at all hanging on the jet. So we got to the end of the runway. The runway at Edwards is 15,000 feet long, so almost 3 miles long. We decided to do an afterburner takeoff, which was wholly unnecessary on a clean F-16, but we're like, you know what? Let's do it. Yeah.
Why not?
America. So we, taxi on the runway and stop, static takeoff, engine run up, clear for takeoff, off we go, full afterburner, rotate, clean up the landing gear. So we were at brick one of the runway, 0 knots, right? We're not moving, static takeoff. 15,000 feet later, if I didn't pull it out of afterburner, we would have been supersonic. So wow. 0 knots to above Mach 1.0 in less than 15,000 feet. So I pulled out an afterburner, and then I stood it on its tail, put it back in afterburner, and rocketed to the moon. So roll out, what seemingly 7 seconds later, 30,000 feet, still doing 300 knots. And it was phenomenal, right? So F-16 is a really fun plane to fly from just around the sports car around the flagpole. But that would not be my choice for a favorite. The Fighting Falcon is not my favorite airplane.
Drum roll. What is it?
I'd have to pick the mighty Strike Eagle, right? It's hard to deny the Mud Hen. And you get into the way it is configured now with especially the EX. You got the ESA radar. You got the big motors. Two people, right? Single seat out there can hate on me, but you get a good whistle in the back seat. Tux or Rocky or Hook, may he rest in peace. Other, phenomenal whizzos. And the work that you can do is, it's incredible. So Strike Eagle, honor to fly, right? I've got more than 1,000 total hours in 15 CD&E. And can't pick anything other than this mighty Strike Eagle.
Keeping to the bread and butter.
That's right.
All righty. Well, sir, thanks so much for coming on. Obviously, this was a longer podcast, but absolutely fantastic.
Thanks.
The radar EW conversation, test pilot conversation, I've been wanting to have this conversation for a very long time. And I knew you had a lot of stories from having you in class and stuff. So thanks again for taking time out of your schedule.
Thank you.
So this has been the Flyover Podcast, episode 20. Thanks again to Colonel Egan. All these episodes are available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts with clips on our Instagram and YouTube shorts. With that, we will catch you all in the next one.